Hello, everyone. I am having to speak quite quietly because it's pretty late at night and my flatmates are asleep, so hope you can forgive that. But at about 6:30 p.m. on Wednesday the 6th of January, I recorded this episode, and the initial goal of it was to explain what happened with this Georgia Senate runoff, this Georgia Senate election, and I wanted to get you squared away on why that is such a big deal. But as I finished up recording, I switched on CNN, intending to find out more information about this Georgia thing, and I watched live footage of people, of terrible people, smashing in the windows of the Capitol building in Washington, D.C., and storming inside. The Capitol building, by the way, it's the equivalent of our Houses of Parliament in the UK, in Westminster. So it's where the House of Representatives and the Senate are, in the same way that our House of Commons and our House of Lords are located in the same building. So it'd literally be like turning on the TV and watching a load of people storm through the Houses of Parliament. It's just unthinkable. I know this podcast is actually particularly aimed at people who don't always watch the news, and it's here to sort of catch you up, but I am confident that you will have seen footage or pictures of what went down in Washington. It is dreadful and disgusting and unheard of. In fact, the last time, according to CNN, the last time that the US Capitol building had been breached in this manner was when the British attacked it in 1814. So that's how not a thing this is. But I'm going to first just explain a bit about this event, give you some details around it, what spurred it on. And then after that, normal programming will resume, if you will. So you'll get to hear the podcast that I would have put out had this horrendous event not happened. So yeah, no music for this first bit. It's just too disgusting to even make light of and to be irreverent about. So I'm just going to explain it. Essentially, there was this sort of ceremony where both houses of Congress were going to officially confirm Joe Biden's election win. It really is just ceremonial. It couldn't ever change the result. Just interrupting that event would not change the course of history. That chapter is closed. Joe Biden won the election. But even so, Trump was determined to put a stop to this event. On January 1st, on New Year's Day, Trump tweeted, this is a quote, "The big protest rally in Washington, D.C. will take place at 11 a.m. on January the 6th. Locational details to follow. Stop the steal." And of course, stop the steal is referring to Trump's conviction, utter conviction, that the election has been stolen from him. And a few weeks before that, he tweeted about these protests before saying, "Be there, it'll be wild." So these are his words, you know, it'll be wild, stop the steal. These are instructions. So unsurprisingly, at this joint Congress event that is largely ceremonial, this growing crowd of, well, initially protesters was what we thought they were, protesters gathered at the Capitol building where this was meant to be happening to stop the steal in their eyes. That's why they were there. And again, stopping it happening would not somehow plant Trump back in the White House for another 4 years. This just wouldn't make a real difference. But anyway, that was the goal of these protesters. And they were chanting, you know, "We want Trump, stop the steal," what have you, outside the building. And then it seemed like in a really short space of time, things just got unbelievably sinister. And they managed to break onto the actual site, so past the barricades and right up against the building, which was surreal in itself because you're not even meant to get to that point. It's kind of the same here in the UK. You can go up to House of Parliament, you can go up to Big Ben, but you can't get right up next to the building. There's a gap between where punters can get up to and where the building starts. So that already seemed unnerving, to have these crowds breaking over the barricades and getting right up into the, you know, up to the walls of the building. And then it was inevitable. It just kind of deteriorated. People started scaling the walls, literally climbing the walls, banging on the doors, smashing the windows. And then ultimately this sort of crowd stormed in. And the pictures are astonishing. I have no doubt that you'll have seen them. So you don't need me to describe them. But imagine for the people inside the building, just workers, obviously elected officials, it'll have been terrifying, but even just the staff that aren't elected, they're just trying to do their jobs. It must have been just the stuff of nightmares. Having the security team there shouting, like, lock yourselves in your offices, hide under your desks, like, do what you can. And then other people being told to evacuate if it was safe to do so. Like, it's genuinely the kind of stuff that you would have nightmares about. And don't get me wrong, some of these protesters were armed, as we found out, because one woman has been shot. Very little details about that as I'm recording this podcast, but one woman has been shot. Guns were drawn. People were looting things from Capitol Building. People were fighting with law enforcement. It got really violent. And then the most sort of stunningly dreadful thing, really about all of this, was Trump's inaction. He initially sort of tweeted these really lightweight tweets, hardly condemning it at all. And then eventually, after this got so out of hand, that military backup was required, full riot police were there, the mayor had to instate a curfew, a 6 p.m. till 6 a.m. curfew. After all of that, Trump finally put out a video. It was a minute long video on his Twitter. And when I saw that, I was like, oh, he's going to condemn these people. Finally, he's gonna order them to stop. He's going to tell them that he doesn't condone anything they're doing, and they're going to be arrested and they're going to be punished. And that's what this video is going to say. But I could not have been more wrong. The tone of that video was completely different.
I know your pain. I know you're hurt. We had an election that was stolen from us. It was a landslide election, and everyone knows it, especially the other side. But you have to go home now. We have to have peace. We have to have law and order. We have to respect our great people in law and order. We don't want anybody hurt. It's a very tough period of time. There's never been a time like this where such a thing happened, where they could take it away from all of us, from me, from you, from our country. This was a fraudulent election, but we can't play into the hands of these people. We have to have peace. So go home. We love you. You're very special. You've seen what happens. You see the way others are treated that are so bad and so evil. I know how you feel. But go home and go home in peace.
So that was Trump's message to these people. It is disturbing. On the one hand, he's telling them to respect the police, but on the other hand, he's telling them that he loves them and that they're special. It just doesn't feel like real life. Anyway, that's what led to that event. We'll see in the coming sort of 24 hours, 48 hours, what the consequences of that are. But now I am going to play you the podcast that I originally recorded. I will pick back up with you at the end because things are very different. I can't really leave it on the note that I did originally. But hopefully this will help you understand what happened with the Senate race in Georgia. Hello, this is Bare Naked Politics. It is indeed the best podcast in the world for following what's happening in the news. And I'll tell you for why. Because you don't have to be an expert in politics to understand what I'm on about. Instead, I just strip all the politics stuff back to basics. I make it really easy to understand. And I promise you that even if you haven't watched the news in a year, you will come away from this episode feeling informed. You're not going to feel confused, as, in my opinion, you quite often do when it comes to other politics podcasts. So if that sounds good, make sure you subscribe or hit follow, depending on what platform you're listening on. I'm Julia Bell, and today we're going to have a quickie. It won't be a long episode, but there's still quite a lot to cover because it's a big story we're talking about. This big story in Georgia, where Georgia, the state, not the country, where Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff are now the two senators for the state of Georgia. The Democrat senators at that. So for the first time in decades, Georgia has two Democrat senators. That's the news today. And in fact, there's lots of firsts here. Raphael Warnock is the first black candidate ever to be elected senator in the state of Georgia. And John Ossoff, who, by the way, is really young. I think he's, I'm going to check, but I think he's 33. Yeah, John Ossoff, 33. And he is the first Jew to be elected, first Jewish senator to be elected senator in the state of Georgia. So in that sense, it is big news just on its own. But the real reason that I'm doing a podcast on this is because the result of these two Senate seats will actually make a much bigger impact than just on people in Georgia. This is going to genuinely transform Joe Biden's first couple of years in the White House as the president. That's how big this story spans. So yeah, I'm going to explain what happened. I'm going to explain why it affects Joe Biden's presidency. I'm just going to talk about all of it. All right, so as you know, even if you haven't watched the news for a year, you will know that Joe Biden won the election. It doesn't matter what Donald Trump is saying on Twitter. This is not a debate. Biden won it, and by a substantial amount as well. So he will be inaugurated on the 20th of January, even if it means Trump has to be sedated and dragged out by his ankles. It's happening. And that's all well and good for Biden. That is a brand new era for America. But just being the US president doesn't mean that you can just do whatever you want and that you can pass whatever laws you like. A president has to get past the Senate and the House of Representatives first. So if you don't get approval from them, it's very hard to make any changes. And in fact, Obama will be the first person to tell you that, because he just had a terrible time towards the end of his presidency. I remember him making a speech about gun control at one point, right towards the end of his presidency, maybe in the last year, in 2016. And it was in the event of all these shootings that were happening in schools and whatnot. And he felt powerless and he was sort of reduced to tears making this speech, talking about how things need to change, we need to take action. But of course, he couldn't really take any action because he didn't have both of the houses of Congress on his side. It is kind of like here in the UK, the Prime Minister can't just pass laws without getting a majority of votes of approval from MPs in the House of Commons and from peers in the House of Lords. So it is quite reflective in that sense of what happens here in the UK. So for Joe Biden, he's in quite a cushy position in one sense, because the House of Representatives, which is kind of like the American House of Commons, that has a majority of Democrats, Biden's fellow Democrats from his party. So that's one quite nice thing for him. He's got one house, generally speaking, on his side. Now all he wants is a majority of Democrats in the Senate. And then he's cooking. Then it's really quite exciting for him. And that brings me to this story about Georgia, because both of Georgia's senators were up for re-election, or both of Georgia's Senate seats were up for re-election. And these two little seats that, to be honest, this is a British podcast, I probably wouldn't have done a podcast about this had it not had the power to tip the balance in the Senate. These two little seats make all the difference. Because the way it stood, if the Republicans just got one of those seats in Georgia, which we now know they didn't do, but if they had, then they'd have had a majority. The Republicans would have had a majority in the Senate. It would have been 51-49. So it wouldn't have been much, but it would have been something. If they got both, even better, then it would have been 52-48. The Democrats, being slightly behind in numbers, they needed both seats just to make it a tie. So what's happened here, as we've seen, Ossoff and Warnock, the two Democrats, they won, they bagged the seats. So now the Senate is tied 50-50. And you might be thinking, well, why is this such good news for Joe Biden? You know, how does that mean he has a majority, and how are they going to make any decisions if the two parties just vote against each other in this completely split deadlock? And this is the thing. In the event, and this is just American politics for you, in the event of a tie vote, where it's completely 50-50, guess who casts the tiebreaker? It's the vice president. So that is what's music to Biden's ears, because his VP, Kamala Harris, who he was jaunting all over the country with and who his kind of partner in crime is, she's the deciding voter on deadlock votes in the Senate. So, well, she will be come the 20th of January when they're both inaugurated. So, like I say, a lot was riding on these two Senate seats. And that's why the Democrats were desperate for both of them, because then they could tie it up and Kamala Harris would be the tiebreaker. I realise, actually, that you haven't heard from Warnock or Ossoff yet. So let's play their victory speeches from today, which is the 6th of January as I'm recording this. So first of all, you're going to hear from Raphael Warnock, and then you're going to hear from John Ossoff.
So I come before you tonight as a man who knows that the improbable journey that led me to this place in this historic moment in America could only happen here. We were told that we couldn't win this election. But tonight, we prove that with hope, hard work, and the people by our side, anything is possible.
It is with humility that I thank the people of Georgia for electing me to serve you in the United States Senate. Thank you for the confidence and trust that you have placed in me. At this moment of crisis, as COVID-19 continues to ravage our state and our country, when hundreds of thousands have lost their lives, millions have lost livelihoods, having difficulty making ends meet, let's unite now to beat this virus and rush economic relief to the people of our state and to the American people.
So there you go. That was Raphael Warnock first, because his victory was called first, and then Ossoff second, who actually made that speech before he was confirmed the winner officially by the media. So in America, it's kind of the media, each outlet, that calls the winner. And they do it on different times based on their own kind of set of criteria and their own team that decide it. And I use CNN. That's the outlet that I like to use. And they still, as I'm recording this podcast, and it's 6:30 in the afternoon, in the evening, they still haven't called it. But Ossoff, he could see the way this was going. The vote count was coming in, and he went, okay, I've won this thing. I'm just going to make the speech. So, yeah, let's hope for his sake that he didn't jinx it. But no, we can be pretty sure that Warnock, who is a 51-year-old African-American pastor, and John Ossoff, a 33-year-old ex-documentary maker and investigative journalist, they are now the Georgian senators. Now, you might be thinking, why did this election happen this week? All the other senators are accounted for. Why is Georgia just sticking out on its own and having this big event? Well, Georgians initially voted in line with everybody else. They voted on the same day as the presidential election in November for these two Senate seats. It's weird. In America, they vote for loads of things at once, and their ballot on a presidential election is like a huge shopping list. At the top, you get to choose your president, but underneath, if there's senators up for re-election, if there's local councillors up for re-election, all the way down to random referendums on stuff, it's all on one ballot. So back in November, Georgians had that choice, but these two Senate seat results were inconclusive at the time. So both of them just happened to be inconclusive. And the reason for that was too many people were running for each seat. You had multiple people from each party. You had independents running. It was dead complicated. And nobody was able to get more than 50% of the overall vote on their own. So nobody got a majority for either seat. And that meant it had to go into what's called a runoffs phase. That's what this is. It's the Senate runoffs in Georgia. If you've heard that term, then you know now. And it's kind of like a sudden death round where they did the first round, not enough people got, or nobody got enough votes. So then they kick out everybody who didn't come in the top two places. So anyone who didn't do very well, kick everyone out, and they just do it again with the final two places. It's just what Americans needed, is just more tension and more uncertainty and more excuses to fall out with each other. But that's what this election on the 5th of January was. It was this final round between the top places for these two Senate seats. Now, both seats had been held by Republicans beforehand, and they were both running again this time to try and hold on to their seats. So their names were David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler. So they were just senators trying to hold on to their seats. And typically, in Georgia, over the last however many decades, if it gets to a runoffs phase, Republicans win. It's just this trend in Georgian Senate runoffs that the Republicans always win. So I think going into this, there was a degree of confidence, I suppose, because this is just what the pattern is. But this year, the trend truly was bucked, and neither senator was able to hold on to their seats. Both of them failed to do so, with John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock kicking them out. But yeah, a lot of fiddly stuff to explain there. Hopefully that makes sense. I know that American politics is kind of so heavily structured, and there's all this jargon around it that it can be kind of hard to just talk about a story without having to give you loads of context. But hopefully you've got your head around that now. And because of how much was riding on this, you can see why all this disproportionate attention was cast on the state of Georgia. Because this could affect future Supreme Court justice nominations. It could affect future foreign policy. It could affect the environment. Like, this is how much it mattered in terms of Joe Biden's presidency. It affects how much power he's going to have. So it kind of means that internationally, all these commentators, including myself, have this ridiculous knowledge about Georgia now. And considering I've never even been there, I weirdly know quite intimately the geography of all of it, which is weird. But just to prove to you kind of how massive this was, John Ossoff, the Democrat who challenged David Perdue and ultimately beat him, he received the most campaign funding that a Senate candidate has ever had from any state, not just Georgia. I forgot to check the number, so I'm just going to do that now, how much he actually ended up getting. John Ossoff funding. So I'm using this website called Open Secrets, which is where they kind of lay out how much each candidate gets in donations. We can see here, John Ossoff... According to Open Secrets, he raised $138 million. A lot of which will have been sent in from small-scale donors and, like, individuals, you know, just middle-class families or whatever, throwing money at this problem. Because, and a lot of them won't have even been Georgians. People from across the country, people who have never even been to Georgia before, will have been throwing money at this issue. Because if you lived in, like, California or... whatever, Colorado, and you were a diehard Democrat, and you're desperate for Joe Biden to have as much power as possible when he gets into the White House, you're going to donate money to John Ossoff's campaign because it directly affects Joe Biden's presidency. So no wonder it became this massive thing. It must have actually been quite surreal for the four candidates, for Perdue, Loeffler, Ossoff and Warnock, because this huge burden was on their backs. They set out to be senators, which is already quite a big deal, to represent the interests of people from Georgia, and suddenly the whole world is watching. Okay, let's talk about Stacey Abrams. If you haven't heard her name before, she ran to be governor of Georgia in 2018 as a Democrat, and she lost to the Republican candidate Brian Kemp. Trump hates Brian Kemp, by the way. You might have heard me mention this briefly on another episode of the podcast, but this hatred that Trump has for Brian Kemp, who is a Republican, they're from the same party, but it's getting out of control because you know how Trump is convinced that cheating and fraud went on in the election in Georgia? Absolutely convinced. Well, he is really pissed off with Kemp for not backing him up. He's expecting Kemp, who's a fellow Republican and who had until this point kind of supported Trump, he expected him to come out and say, yep, this election's been rigged. Trump won Georgia, even though he didn't. But Kemp is there going, look, I kind of run this state and I'm telling you that there was no issues. There wasn't. There was no cheating. So Trump is now convinced that he is a snake on this long list of people that Trump believes to be cheating snakes who's conspiring against him. But that's by the by. Trump does hate Kemp, but actually, my God, does he hate Stacey Abrams a million times more. I don't think there's a quantitative word to describe how much Trump hates Stacey Abrams, because a lot of people put Biden's victory in Georgia and now the victory of these two Democrat senators down to her. And the reason for that is because when Abrams lost in 2018, she didn't just sort of shrivel away out of the public eye. She grew this fire to create a campaign that would encourage people to turn out and vote in Georgia. Because when she lost, she voiced that she didn't actually think she should have. She voiced that a lot of that was down to voter suppression in her eyes.
This is not a speech of concession, because concession means to acknowledge an action is right, true, or proper. As a woman of conscience and faith, I cannot concede that. Now, I could certainly bring a new case to keep this one contest alive, but I don't want to hold public office if I need to scheme my way into the post, because the title of governor isn't nearly as important as our shared title, voters. And that is why we fight on.
So that was quite an iconic speech where ordinarily the losing candidate would have just said, yeah, I concede, I lost. But instead, there she was saying, no, I don't concede. I recognise I'm not going to be the governor. I'm not trying to do a Donald Trump and say I won when I didn't. But I think the reason for my loss is because hundreds of thousands of people in Georgia couldn't vote And she was listing things like, she listed this huge thing in this speech, you know, people being denied voting because of their handwriting. She talked about polling places not letting people vote because they'd run out of paper. She talked about polling places that were listed as open and they turned out to be closed on the day. People who were queuing for so long that they had to just give up and walk away for fear that they would get in trouble at work. And her reason for being became much less about her personally being in politics and much more about encouraging people in Georgia specifically to A, be able to vote, but B, to vote Democrat. And I think it was Whoopi Goldberg was saying nobody had Joe Biden's back like Stacey Abrams.
Nobody had Joe Biden's back more than Stacey Abrams. I mean, she has been working to make sure that the Democratic Party is doing everything they can do in Georgia to turn it blue. I know all those politicians, those Republican politicians in Georgia, wish now that they had just made you governor. Because I'm sure they're just going, if we had just done that, none of this would be going on.
So yeah, getting Georgians to vote and getting Georgians to vote Democrat is basically what Stacey Abrams set her mind to over the past 2 years since losing that the governor election. And I'm, oh, they call it something stupid in America. What's a governor election actually called again? Hang on. A gubernatorial election. Pardon me. But yeah, that's what she's done. And I'm not just talking about campaigning and fundraising. I'm talking about what she has done in spades, literally tens of millions of dollars for the Biden campaign and these two Senate campaigns. But she's also been strategizing, showing the Democrat Party that they need to not ignore Georgia as a potential state, because that was the issue they were having, was Georgia had consistently and reliably voted Republican every presidential election since 1992. And it had been 20 years since a Democrat had won a Senate seat there. So there was this feeling within the Democrat Party of, let's just not even bother with Georgia because it's such a safe Republican state. Let's focus our time and our resources on places where we actually have a chance, or more of a chance. And she was there saying, look, hang on, I'm from Georgia. I know this state. We have this massively metropolitan state. You know, it's got Atlanta in it, for God's sake. It's a massive city. We've got a huge Black and African American population. We've got a growing Latino population. These are the groups that Democrats typically do well with. So don't ignore that. If you could just capture the voters' imaginations in Georgia, connect with them, you can flip this state. And in fact, while I'm here with you, why don't I just give you the exact blueprint for how you do that? Why don't I just show you exactly what you need to do? So yeah, quite a woman, Stacey Abrams. And a lot of people are saying that she went from losing this race in 2018 to literally changing the entire American political landscape 2 years later. A lot of people are putting these Democrat victories, you know, a lot down to her when it comes to the state of Georgia. All right, that clears you up a little bit about this Senate thing and about what it means. Don't get me wrong, just because the Democrats have the House and technically the Senate, because Kamala Harris is the tiebreaker, it doesn't mean that now Joe Biden can just do whatever he wants all the time. I know in a past episode I used the word glide. He can glide if he gets the Senate, and that pissed quite a few of you off that I said that. So sorry if I got a little bit ahead of myself there, because there are quite a few Democrat politicians that are conservative. They're much more conservative than Joe Biden is. So they won't necessarily side with him when he wants them to all the time. They're not going to consistently stick to their party line, as you'd say. So for instance, you know, during Joe Biden's presidential campaign, he talked a lot about the environment. He talked a lot about healthcare and making it more accessible for people. That sort of stuff, by American standards, is progressive. I know here, you know, even the Conservative Party, whose name is the literal antonym of the word progressive, they say that, you know, healthcare should be accessible. We have the NHS. They say we should focus on the environment. But by American standards, those ideas they're really progressive. So Joe Biden is going to have to be careful that he can get the support of Democrats that are quite conservative, because they don't just all agree with each other on everything. So, for example, there's this guy called Joe Manchin. He's a Democrat senator for West Virginia. He wouldn't vote for a lot of those concepts. You know, if Joe Biden turned around and said, let's do this Green New Deal idea, let's create a completely green economy, Joe Manchin would be like, absolutely not. And actually, he's voted with Trump on quite a lot of stuff, even though he's a Democrat, this guy, this West Virginian senator. So he's kind of a rogue. People like him are the ones that Biden is going to have to be careful about. He's going to have to contend with them. He's going to have to do a lot to persuade them. But that being said, it is going to be a hell of a lot easier to get stuff done than in a world where the Democrats had a minority in the Senate and in the House of Representatives. Okay, there's always more to say. I feel like I need to talk about this Trump and Mike Pence falling out thing, which I truly believe that Trump has like a checklist of all the people that had once supported him, and he's just one by one ticking them off and having a huge fallout with them. That this is his goal in life, is to burn every single bridge he's ever built. But essentially, Donald Trump, the new target on his list is his very own vice president, Mike Pence, because essentially part of the vice president's job is to acknowledge and to certify the presidential election result. And it's just a ceremonial thing. It's not Pence counting the votes himself or approving them. It's just a mouthpiece thing. He just gets up on stage and says, yep, Biden and Harris won. That's all he has to do here. And it's not something that he can refuse. Nobody refuses that. That's just not what is the etiquette ever. But it wouldn't be a Donald Trump story if somebody wasn't shitting all over American etiquette. And actually, I saw a clip on CNN where they were talking about this ceremonial duty that Pence has to do. And they were comparing it to giving out an award at the Oscars. So, you know, George Clooney gets on stage, he opens the envelope, and he is a mouthpiece that looks unreal in a Tom Ford tux. That's what his job is. He doesn't decide the result. He's not sitting with the Academy Award judges and saying, oh, I think we should pick this person. He just gets up on stage and reads the thing. And what Trump is asking Mike Pence to do here is kind of like asking George Clooney to get on stage and to open the envelope and to say, do you know what? I don't agree with this, so I'm just going to go ahead and give this award to myself. Which would be so just unbelievably not okay in any world. So Pence has been put in a bind because it's never fun being on Trump's hit list. But to do Trump's bidding in this instance would be completely shitting all over American democracy. Oh, hang on. Oh, yes. Perfect timing. Just had a notification on my Sky News app that says, hang on, let me get to it. Here we go. Pence, breaking news. Pence defies Donald Trump as he won't go against election count. Donald Trump's going to be livid about that. But he's, I mean, I don't know why this is news, because Trump was asking Pence to do something that he literally couldn't do. The vice president can't just turn around and say, no, I'm not going to read out the accurate election result. But still, Trump doesn't really listen to reason like that. So they are going to have a falling out. Yet another falling out for Donald Trump. To be honest, as someone who really hates confrontation, I don't know how he does it. It must be absolutely exhausting. I would just be riddled with anxiety if this many people hated me, as is the case with Donald Trump. But there you go. This is the life that he's made for himself. So Mike Pence isn't going to do that. He's going to get on stage, he's going to say the result, and he's going to move on with his life. Okay, back to Quiet Voice, Julia. But yeah, I mean, I left the podcast on this note of Mike Pence making this decision to announce Joe Biden the winner at this joint congressional session, this ceremony. And as we saw with the events that unfolded, that had to be abandoned. And in fact, Mike Pence himself had to be evacuated from the Capitol building with high security. So that's how much threat he personally was under. I have just seen on CNN now that they do intend to pick up the session where they left off once the situation has been cleared off, although I intend to be very much asleep by the time that happens, so you'll have to keep tabs on that. And it's mad that Mike Pence had to be escorted out because of the threat, when a matter of days ago he was the ultimate enabler of Donald Trump, and indeed of Donald Trump's support base. You know, he was the yes man. Whatever Donald Trump wanted to do, he would do it. And it just shows how much things can really turn on a dime when you rub shoulders with Donald Trump, because now he is public enemy number one of Trump's support base. But yeah, there you have it. I hope that was useful. I hope that helps you navigate the last sort of 24 hours of craziness in America. Actually, if you are an American listener, I just want you to know my heart's with you at the moment. That must have been really tough to watch, because it just shouldn't have happened. People breaking into the crux of your democracy is a violation of your identity, and it's just disgusting. So we're with you, and I'm really sorry that that had to happen to you today. Listen, get in touch on social media at @JuliaBell_X. Message me your questions and I can answer them in future episodes. And if you want to keep this podcast going, if you want to show your support, the best thing you can do is become a patron. I'll put the link in the episode description, but essentially you just click the link, you can buy me a coffee, and it helps get me through well, these very late nights for one, but it also just helps ensure that this podcast can keep going. So if you find it useful, that's the best thing you can do. All right, I'll speak to you in the next one. Thank you. Bye.